Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Mondays at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And we are also linking to our guests' website, and we encourage you to do the same. We encourage you to check them out and see what they have to offer, because what they have to offer, I think, is quite extraordinary. It may resonate with you, and if it does, we encourage you to check it out. I think that you'll really enjoy it. Today's guest is no exception, and I have to say that we've had him on the program before. We're going to talk to him here in 2016, and I've always enjoyed conversations with folks of his, I think I'm going to use the word ilk, Howard.
I'm an ilk. I have great big horns on my head.
Well, not elk, but you have some incredible materials that you've created. How I Accidentally Started the 60s. The one book in particular we're going to talk about, which my wife has started to read and is just rather enthralled as well as perplexed, The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. You've also written such titles as The Genesis of the Beast, a Radical Revision of Capitalism, The Genius of the Beast, beg your pardon.
Right.
And then there's also the Muslim Code. Why do I think that that's sort of a book that came out many years ago called The God Code? I remember interviewing the author of that book back then, The Muslim Code, The Muhammad Code, and Why a Desert Prophet Wants You Dead. We also have...
Well, there's an updated title to that, because we're working on a new version that will come out in the spring of 2017. It's now called, or the new version will be called, The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, or How Muhammad Invented Jihad. And that will be available in about a year.
We also have the Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century. And one of my personal favorites, The Lucifer Principle, a scientific expedition into the forces of history. Interesting titles, to say the least, as well as the material that is contained within. But we're going to talk primarily about The God Problem. And I remember when the book first arrived and the materials first arrived via email, my first thought was, I didn't know God had a problem. I mean, he's God after all, you know? That was my first reaction. Yes, we do.
Well, it's all down to us. I mean, I'm an atheist and I'm a scientist. Well, okay, that's all very fine, but this is a very peculiar universe, and how did it get to be that way? I mean, we went 13.7 billion years ago, if our current figuring about things is correct, we went from an absolute nothing, not even a blip or a pip, to a Big Bang. And that Big Bang had an entire universe implicit in it. I mean, it was infinitely smaller than the smallest pinprick, and yet there was a whole universe implicit in it, just as if it were a swollen belly gestating something brand new. And from absolute nothing came these unbelievable new properties, space and time and speed. And the space and time and speed with a space-time manifold that was speeding open like some sort of a giant's handkerchief that had been sneezed into a massive expansion. And where do space and time come from? If you and I had been sitting around at a coffee table at the beginning of the universe, and we'd been sitting around long before there had been any sort of a Big Bang, and you had taken a look at that speeding sheet of space and time and said to me, Howard, I predict that any 10 to the minus 30 seconds of a second from now, the first things are going to appear. And I would have said, Richard, you're crazy. There are no things. That's why they call this the nothing. There never were things. There never will be things. And the first things, the first elementary particles, come precipitating like raindrops from a storm cloud. And those things eventually gather together into these massive sweepings of dust and gas that we call galaxies and black holes and stars and planets and eventually you and me. And if you're like me, a stone-cold atheistic scientific type, how in the world does any of this happen? And it's the big missing question in science these days. We're not asking, the first two rules of science are these are the way I learned them at the age of 10, and they have captivated me for the rest of my life. The first rule of science is the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And the second rule of science is look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. Well, virtually everything that's under our nose is startling, shocking, and surprising. How in the world did it come to be? And that's the question behind the God problem.
Well, and it's interesting that I've myself asked a lot of these same kinds of questions, been perplexed by a lot of the answers, and primarily the perplexivity, if you will, of my mind at the time was, your answers don't make any logical sense, people, the whatever group that I happened to be questioning at the time. You know, you give me an explanation, but it doesn't make any sense. And I've always thought, and of course I'm using more, I guess you might say theist perspective, that the creator, who or whatever he, she, it might be, they, gave us this brain. And even in some of the many ancient wisdom teachings, as I like to call them, Howard, they talk about how we've been given this capacity to reason together. So why are you believing in and promoting superstition and old, unworkable belief systems when you've been given this capacity to reason through some of these things? Because the explanations that you've given me about my questions, again, they just don't make sense.
Well, you used the magic word a few seconds ago, and that was logic. They don't make any logical sense. What we don't realize is the problem is not with you, the problem is not with me, the problem is with logic. And logic is something far more tiny and confined than we think it is. It's something that Aristotle came up with about 350 B.C. And Aristotle said this. He laid out a program in two pages of one of his books. He laid out a whole program for the future of science. And among other things, he said that if you take something and you reduce it down to its tiniest little parts, and he called those parts elements, and you discover how those tiny little parts work. He used a strange metaphor. He used a metaphor from Hammurabi had the codes of human behavior carved into a giant piece of stone. And those codes of human behavior, once they were written down or carved on a block of granite, were called laws. So Aristotle said, once you understand the laws of those tiniest elements of things, then you understand everything. Well, unfortunately, he's wrong. You know, we've gone to the lengths. We have followed Aristotle's program right down to the nth degree, breaking things down apart to their tiniest particles, and those particles are called, he called them elements. So he called whatever laws he felt were governing those elements, elementary laws. We've been doing that for so long that we've spent between $10 and $15 billion on the Hadron Collider at CERN in Europe. It's a huge machine. And what is it doing? It's following Aristotle's instructions. It is breaking things down to their tiniest parts. But there is a problem, and the problem shows up in the five heresies that are featured in the God problem. And it's that it isn't the tiniest of parts that can entirely explain things. In fact, they leave the explanation lacking in some big way. I mean, if we want to explain how you, Richard Dugan, are functioning, to say that your brain has 100 billion neurons gets us nowhere, because you are not in any of those 100 billion neurons. There's some larger whole that comes into existence when that 100 billion neurons get together and works not just on its own, but in the context of 7 billion other brains. There's a big picture. It's like you imagine taking one brick of charcoal and dousing it in lighter fluid and lighting a match. You get this astonishing thing called a flame that dances around in front of your eyes, that never stops moving, and yet has a form, a structure of its own, despite the fact that it's undergoing constant change. Now, if you were to try to answer the question of what a flame is by simply smashing the charcoal briquette to its smallest little pieces, you get nowhere, because the flame is what we call in science an emergent property. It's something that comes from a whole, or a bunch of things getting together and forming a whole that is larger than any of its parts. And in science, for the last 2,300 years, ever since Aristotle, we've been missing the emergent properties. We've been missing the flames. We've been missing the wholes. We've been missing what is your soul, what is your consciousness, what is your personality. We've been missing what are the things that are the equivalent of souls and personalities in the universe. And you could say, oh, that's a silly question. What's the equivalent of a soul and personality in the universe? Once upon a time, 350,000 years into the universe's existence, up until that point, there were elementary particles, but they were crashing and bashing into each other at speeds higher than the speeds at which two bullets would hit each other in midair, if you could ever aim them that precisely. And as soon as they ricocheted off each other, these elementary particles were ricocheting off of other particles. It was a bump-and-car smash-up. And if you, again, I had been sitting around at that coffee table at the beginning of the universe, and we're 350,000 years into things, and you had made a, because you're the visionary, I'm the old stick in the mud, and you had said, see those little tiny things that are bashing and smashing around, and see those great big things that are smashing and bashing around, these things that the little tiny things are relatively speaking the size of your fist, and the great big things are relatively speaking the size of the Empire State Building. I'm going to predict that those two things are going to get together. And I'd say, Richard, you're crazy. I've been here for 350,000 years watching this bump-em car smash up, and all things have ever done is bounced off of each other. Plus, why in the world would something, relatively speaking, the size of your fist, ever get together with something the size of the Empire State Building? And sure enough, you'd be right, Richard, because the universe would start slowing down. All those particles would start slowing down. That's called cooling, when things slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, these little tiny things the size of your fist, which are electrons, relatively speaking, and these things, relatively speaking, the size of the Empire State Building, would find that they have an inanimate longing, and that their inanimate longing for each other precisely fits, no matter how grotesque this combination of a fist and an Empire State Building is. Now, the remarkable thing is, you would think that if we're just adding an electron, the giant thing is called a proton, if we're just adding a proton to an electron, all you get is a proton plus an electron. You know, 1 plus 1 equals 2. But no, something much bigger than either an electron or a proton, in fact, a whole set of properties, much bigger than just an electron or a proton emerge. And those properties are the properties we call atom. Those two things together make a whole new set of properties that are atomic. And the second is hydrogen. What? Where in the world did these strange phantasms of properties called an atom and hydrogen come from? It's only an electron and a proton, for God's sakes. Follow Aristotle's logic. Just break it down to its smallest component parts and look at the laws of those two components, and you'll understand everything, right? Wrong. You will never understand an atom that way by simply understanding an electron and a proton. You will never understand what hydrogen is by simply understanding an electron and a proton. So these flame-like properties, like yourself and your consciousness, start popping up at the very earliest stages of the universe. They're all over the place. And in science, we're supposed to look at the things right under our nose. These emergent properties, these flame-like properties, are all over the place. We're not looking. It's time to look very, very hard. And what we discover is the most startling universe you could possibly imagine.
Well, your example of the flame provokes a question that I asked. We live here in Santa Barbara up on the hill, and of course we have a wood burning fireplace, a fireplace that we throw wood in to heat up the house and keep ourselves warm and so forth. And one of the thoughts that came to me was, what is this? I mean, I know what wood is. Okay, I know the properties of wood, and I know that when I strike a match, and I'm going to have to shift from the match or the lighter directly to the ignition of this. My question was, what is the flame made of?
How does it do this weird dance?
Well, there's that too. Yeah, but it's like I know that it is the interaction in some way, shape, or form. Somehow, I've managed to initiate a transformational process of the wood into something else that generates this lighted, flickering, moving, dancing thing. But what is the flame? I mean, because we always are trying to define what things are. We always want to know what things are.
Think about that question for a second.
Okay.
Our answers to what things are always what they're made of. And it isn't so much, yes, it's very useful to spend 2,300 years, which is the time we spend asking that question, what are things made of? But then the question is, now that we have the parts, how do the parts come together and make something that has a real solid existence? I mean, a flame, you could say, a flame doesn't have a solid existence. I can put a metal rod through it. If I had the courage, I could put my hand through it. Yeah, but your hand would be sizzled.
Yeah, exactly.
You would definitely know that something real is there. And so what I'm saying is we've traditionally looked down to answer the question of what in the world is it, and it's time to look up instead to the higher level properties that emerge from these are social aggregations. When you have an electron getting together with a proton and forming an atom, that's a social aggregation, even though it's only a social aggregation of two. When you have 100 billion cells getting together and forming a U, that's a social aggregation. And we don't know how social aggregations manage to produce these astonishing phantom-like properties of self and flame.
But there's another element to all of this, too, that I look at, and that is that over the centuries, as science has progressed, science takes the position that, and I'm going to just use this arbitrary number, there are 10 laws of the universe, and we've discovered them all. And then a few years later, they find the 11th. And I'm sitting here thinking, wait a minute, how arrogant is it of man to think that he's discovered all of the laws, that we know exactly how the universe works, and we're such infinitesimal. I mean, heck, when I stand out here on the beach, on the ocean's edge, and I look out, I'm going, man, I am one tiny, tiny critter in this vastness of the universe. Who am I to say that I know all the rules and laws of the universe? And that's where I'm going with this, that, we've got it all now. And then, so we're going to build the Hadron Collider, because we know how everything works, and we're going to discover, God knows what we're going to discover or what we're going to create or destroy in the process. And of course, those were some of the big fears with this thing that, you're going to create a black hole. How do we know? And so this goes to a sort of a question that I've often put forth to people, and that is, just because we can, does that mean we should? Just because we can go to the moon, does that mean we should? Just because we can build the atomic bomb, does that mean we should? Just because we can take stem cells and grow new body parts, does that mean we should? And so I know we're delving into more ethics and morals in that respect, but how does, because I'm not a scientist, but I hopefully think in some fashion in that way, how does science approach these kinds of things? If they discover it, then let's just go and we'll see what happens, as opposed to, if we go this direction, we don't know exactly what this is going to do to the species, to the planet, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, science has no ethical or moral point of view on these things, because that's not what science gives us.
Mm-hmm.
Science gives us understanding. But my own opinion is this is the most audacious cosmos you can possibly imagine. This is a cosmos that is constantly stretching into the realm of impossibility and yanking the impossible into the realm of reality, like it did with a Big Bang that came from nothing, like it did with forming these twosomes of these Empire State Building-sized things with these fist-sized things and making the first atoms, like it did with stars, galaxies, and black holes. It is constantly doing impossible, unbelievable, supersized, surprise things. And we are a manifestation of the cosmos, and it's our job to keep up our part of the cosmic bargain or the cosmic tradition, which is imagine the most audacious things you possibly can, and then take those things, no matter how impossible, and turn them into realities. And we've done that with our technologies. We've been doing it. We are the only creatures on the face of the planet, aside from naked mole rats, who are born to eat meat. our digestive system is built around eating meat. There's a chemical in your gut called cholecystokinin. It only goes off. It only sends a message from your stomach to your brain if you've eaten meat. And then it's a social chemical. It says, hey, you're eating meat with a bunch of people. These must be good people. Bond with them. Hang around with them. You're likely to get more meat in the future. Mm-hmm. So here we are, physiologically crafted to eat meat. And where are our claws? Where are our fangs? Mm-hmm. We are born without any of the equipment that it takes to get meat.
Mm-hmm.
Worse than that, all other creatures are really good at something called thermoregulation. Your dog manages to go out and take a walk with you when it's 100 degrees out. But if you live in a nice wintry place like New York City, and when the snow is 3 feet deep, your dog is so eager to go out with you, it's ridiculous. That dog's thermoregulatory system, its fur and its internal body stuff, is capable of handling everything from minus 30 degrees to 100 degrees. That's a pretty wide range. Well, we humans are born without any of that thermoregulatory equipment. Why? Because we're the first animals, we're the first technological animals. Now, other animals have their own tiny technologies. Birds make nests. Beavers build dams. But we have the ability to invent technologies, not simply to inherit how to make a technology from our ancestors and from our genes. So we are Homo technologicus, and we invented our own fur coats. Well, actually, we stole them from other animals. Our own equipment for thermoregulation. When clothes were not enough, we invented another thermoregulatory technology called walls, mm-hmm. Tents, portable habitats or habitats at all, and we've invented replacements for claws and for teeth.
Okay, but
they're stone tools.
But you've raised some very important points that draw me to a conclusion that I was sharing with my wife, and she says that based upon everything that you have just described, one of the theories is that we are not indigenous to this planet. Okay?
No, Richard, you can think of it in exactly the opposite manner.
Okay.
One way of thinking of it is this. If God had wanted us to handle cold weather, he would have given us fur. If God had wanted us to eat meat, he would have given us claws mm-hmm. and fangs.
Okay.
No, it's the other way around. If God gave us or created us, we'll use God just as a metaphor for
sure.
the moment.
Mm-hmm.
God created us without fur and without fangs and claws to challenge us to make our own. Why? Because this is a universe of manic mass assembly of things that are absolutely impossible. It's the cosmos of the supersized surprise. And the cosmos has been pulling off supersized surprises long before consciousness and creativity and intellect and culture ever came along. But now that the universe has given birth to us and we do have consciousness and we do have imagination and we do have the ability to pursue something like flying for a total of, that's a dream that has been around for 3,000 years before we first managed to achieve it. That was a multi-generational process. The universe has given us the capacity to carve, to fantasize about impossible things, and then to turn those fantasies into realities. Why? So we would dream our tails off. So we would take what she has been doing for 13.7 billion years and turn it up five notches. So we would start dreaming impossible things and pulling them from the realm of the impossible into reality at a speed that goes beyond the speed at which the cosmos has ever pulled us off in the past. This is a cosmos of audacity. This is a cosmos of gumption. This is a cosmos of balls. This is a cosmos that goes constantly beyond anything you can imagine.
Hmm.
And we are here to be the new Imagineers and the new fingertips of her yanking things from the realm of the impossible into the realm of the everyday.
You know, I love these, I don't want to call them mind games, but I love the intellectual challenge that is presented in conversations such as this. And I love going to the five points that you draw upon. Two of them are quite interesting because it brings to mind a concept or a type of math that was introduced. I remember hearing the story about this, and this has to do with both your first and second points as far as A does not equal A and 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. And it had to do with a type of math called whole math. And this was the way it went. You had a classroom full of children, and you have the equation that 1 plus 1 equals 2. But the answer isn't 2. The answer is, children, let's decide what 1 plus 1 equals, and that will be the answer.
Right.
That was what whole math was.
That's tricky, because in reality, the universe is very specific about things. It doesn't let you make your mind up about anything. When you decide to cross a street, if you've made a decision at the wrong time and a bus is coming along, that's the end of you.
Mm-hmm.
There's no relativism there. You know, you can't simply wish the bus out of existence. So, and math is a matter, as we continue to evolve math, like our other tools, of finding what is possible given the restrictions of this universe and what is not. Now, the things that are possible are, it turns out, tremendously numerous, but they're limited. You can't cross the street in front of the bus. And when it comes to 1 plus 1, there are five heresies in the God problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. And the second one is 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. And that's because, let's go back to the particle the size of your fist, mm-hmm. relatively speaking,
okay.
and the particle the size of the Empire State Building, relatively speaking. Remember, garbage in, garbage out, that's simple Aristotelian-style logic.
Right.
So put in an electron and a proton. Richard, I swear to you, all you should ever, ever get is an electron and a proton. That's it, an electron and a proton. That's 1 plus 1 equals 2. And yet you get an atom. You don't even get 1 plus 1 equals 3. You get something that's off the number line altogether.
Mm.
Altogether. And so we have to learn how to think in terms of these larger things that emerge when you get social groups together. I mean, all a galaxy is at that 350,000-year mark into the universe's existence, when electrons and protons discover this inanimate longing for each other and hook up, they couple, they discover something else. It's another social force, because after all, the source that has them coupling is a social force. The other social force they discover is so quiet that it barely whispers, it can barely be heard, and it's gravity. Gravity starts pulling these atoms together. And it does so for roughly the next 650,000 years. And after 650,000 years of sweepings of mere atoms, things so small you can't even see them with a microscope, after 650,000 years of this, you get the beginnings of the first galaxies. And what is a galaxy? It's a herd. It's a mass. It's a congregation. It is a massive society of atoms. And so from social aggregation, from social clumpings, from getting togethers, bizarre, amazing, astonishing things come. A black hole, that's simply a gathering of so many atoms that the gravity begins to swallow everything in its path whole, including light. So we have to come to understand the laws of social things. So when I'm trying to explain to people what I do, I started in science at the age of 10. And I started in theoretical physics and in microbiology. And since then, I've tried to move out to encompass every science and form of math that my meager little mind, and it is a meager little mind, can understand. And I've been putting it together in order to give you new big pictures of the cosmos in which you and I live. But one of the things that I started, a phrase I started using about 20 years ago to try to explain at least one aspect of what I'm doing to people is mass behavior. I specialize in mass behavior, from the mass behavior of elementary particles to the mass behavior of human beings, which means the forces all the way from elementary physics to the forces of history. These two things, the forces of history and the sweepings of elementary particles, the coming together of atoms, they do have things in common. And the things that they have in common is social desire, a social impulse, social structure, because structure immediately begins to impose itself on things. when they get together in big groups. And then this amazement of the flame, emergent properties, things that seem absolutely impossible, coming from the fact that the way in which these things all work together and produce something that's bigger than themselves.
You know, it draws to my mind the observation as I am driving about Santa Barbara and other areas, both within the city as well as on the freeways, that it is, and this actually goes to, and I'm going to see if I can't, yeah, here it is right here. This goes to the third item having to do with the second law of thermodynamics. I don't even know what the first one is, so I'm at a disadvantage there. That all things tend toward disorder and that all things tend towards entropy, and this is wrong. And so my example has to do with, my observation has to do with the fact that in spite of the number, the volume of vehicles, and what I perceive of as the inattentiveness of the operators of those vehicles to operate those vehicles while traversing at medium and high rates of speed and slow speeds and so forth, that you would think that there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of accidents all over the city and the highways, when in
Absolutely.
Fact, by percentage, there aren't.
Right.
That it's amazing. And so then you start taking a look at it from a macro or cosmologic, I hope that's the right word, perspective, that there aren't things out in the universe that are constantly running into each other. Because if that was
right.
the case, the Earth would have been destroyed hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago, and we wouldn't even be here having this conversation.
No, you're absolutely right. The second heresy, there are five heresies in the book. The first heresy is that A does not equal A, and we'll go into that some other time. The second heresy is that 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. These emergent properties come leaping forth when you cluster things together. The third is that the second law of thermodynamics, which everybody who's ever learned much about science believes is absolute truth, is absolute nonsense. The second law of thermodynamics says that all things are constantly falling apart. And the example that's usually given when you're in high school physics is take a sugar cube and drop it into a glass of water. Stir it, and eventually the sugar cube disappears. It dissolves. Well, that is how the whole universe is supposed to operate, according to the second law of thermodynamics. So the universe is supposed to fall apart like that cube of sugar dissolving in the glass of water, until it dies in something called heat death. In other words, the universe is constantly falling apart, according to the second law of thermodynamics. Well, let me submit to you that the universe is not constantly falling apart. It's constantly falling together. Remember that nothingness that suddenly precipitated in a pinprick infinitely smaller than a pinprick with an entire universe in its swelling little belly, the Big Bang. Let me point out that from that Big Bang came space and time, two radically astonishing concepts, not to mention speed. And then came elementary particles, and then came atoms, and then came galaxies, and then came stars, and then eventually came life. The universe is not falling down. The universe is climbing up constantly, and that's why our obligation is to be the ultimate climbers, the ultimate visioneers. The ultimate ones to dream high and then make our dreams come true, because that's the legacy of the cosmos that gave us birth. And the fourth heresy is that randomness really, in the way that we imagine it, doesn't exist in this cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
The great example of randomness that's always been thrown around in conversations like the conversation you and I are having now is the six monkeys at six typewriters. And it is said that if you put six monkeys together at six typewriters in a room all by themselves and you gave them an infinite amount of time, eventually they would type out the entire works of Shakespeare entirely by accident. And so presumably that's how the works of Shakespeare have come to be, through a chain of accidents. No, that's not the way the universe works. If the universe worked that way, then in that, just after that Big Bang, when the first elementary particles came gushing out, again precipitating like raindrops, there would have been an infinite number of kinds of them. Some of them would have been huge, some of them would have been small, some of them would have had elephant trunks, Some of them would have had dazzling nail polish on their fingertips. they would have been bizarre and strange and in no way resembling each other if this were a random universe. But it's not a random universe. How can we tell? Because there are only 16 quarks were one of the very first things that emerged. There are only 16 different forms of quarks with a gazillion identical copies of each. And then 350,000 years later, when the universe starts allowing couplings, marriages between protons and electrons, you would think, well, there should be an infinite number of different kinds of pairings that they would produce. But they don't. They produce only three different kinds of atoms: hydrogen, helium, and lithium. That's it. Three choices in a universe that's supposed to have an infinite number of pairings and mix-ups and match-ups and bizarre zoos of qualities, only three. The universe works in limited ways and turns those limits into the unlimited through the quality of audacity and imagination that she demonstrates at every step of the way.
And, of course, this marriage or coupling is only legal in three states right now.
Yes, right.
We're going to continue our conversation. This just fascinates me to no end. I want to touch upon maybe a sidebar to this, to the God problem. I want to address some, I want to throw at you some spiritual questions, not theological,
okay,
not dogmatic or doctrine, not holy writ kinds of questions, but more theory on from a spiritual perspective, because my experience with people who avow atheism or who are atheists is that, all right, I know what you don't believe in, or even what you do believe in, or what you know. But what I've come to understand is that atheists by nature are very spiritual people. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about that after our break.
No, I don't mind it at all.
All right, we'll be back. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Howard Bloom, and we're talking about the God problem. And it sounds to me like there is an aspect, Howard, not of a lack of intellect in the universe in terms of humanity's ability to understand, but it's more a lack of willingness to let go of our beliefs in what things are, and a willingness to consider these possibilities. That's kind of my observation. And a gentleman who's been on this program many times, Greg Braden, he wrote a book called The Healing of a Belief. And he talked about the transition from belief is to knowing, that we won't need to believe in things anymore, because as we grow, as we evolve, we will know these things. And it's not, hey, I know that the earth is round kind of thing, and you just kind of tout that. No. We will understand the principles, as you are alluding to and elucidating here on the program, to the point where, no, I don't believe that there is dark matter. I know that there is, although I say that facetiously, because I find it fascinating. There's no evidence to support the existence of dark matter. Science has said this. I've listened to numerous programs discussing it. There's no way to measure it, but they say it's there. And I'm going, wait a minute. Is this the same theory as I know that oxygen is there, that I breathe in and out of my nostrils, but I can't see it, taste it, feel it, hear it, or smell it, but I know that I'm taking it in and blowing out carbon dioxide, you know, and certainly I know that science has shown us that, yes, there is that gas there that allows us to exist, to continue to function. But I want to jump into the whole, again, this is the kind of the same argument regarding spirituality, not religion, not theology, not doctrine and dogma, not holy writ. We're now talking about this concept, if you will, of our having this essence that inhabits the physical body and that moves on to, I don't know what when the body dies. When the it's just I look at it as how many cars have you owned in your lifetime, Howard?
Actually, I live in New York City where you don't have to own cars because you've got subways.
Sure.
So I've never owned a car.
All right. But but you use various forms or various forms of vehicular motion, if you will, planes,
right,
trains, automobiles, as well as walking, to get from point A to point B, which is what a car is all about anyway, regardless,
right,
of all of the other stuff. And the physical body is the same kind of thing. It's to get from point A, which in essence is birth, to point B, which is death, which I'm still,
right,
trying to wrap my brain around. Why? What's the point,
right,
of going from point A to point B if we're going to wind up at point B anyway? And some people say, well, yeah, we've been at point B before, you know,
right,
you know, post point B, if you will. That's where we came from. That's where we're going. And I'm going, why are we taking this detour? You know?
Right.
So tell me a little bit about the spiritual realm in reference to the God problem.
Well, if you go back to those first two rules of science, the truth, mm-hmm, at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. That second law is a law of awe. It's a law of wonder. It's a law of perception. And sometimes we have to let ourselves be awed so that we can wonder about things, so that we can pursue new questions. Now, there's a second element here. We're talking about the fact that 1 plus 1 does not equal 2 because you get something far higher when you put an electron and a proton together. You get an atom and you get hydrogen. And in the same way, there is something you and I, our consciousness is like that flickering flame above the charcoal briquette, and we have no clue as to what it is. There is a meeting of consciousness studies experts in Arizona every single year, and despite the fact that in psychology and physics, people have been turning, scientists have been turning their attention to consciousness for the last 30 years at least, no one has a clue as to what that's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And in my life, I find that it's extremely necessary to pursue these things. The fact that you're an atheist gives you an even greater necessity of trying to sense all of the things that are difficult to sense, of trying to have all of the ecstatic experiences that are a part of the religious experience. For some reason, when I was 14 years old, I heard about a book called The Varieties of the Religious Experience, and I got wildly excited. We didn't have Amazon in those days. It took me 6 months to track down a copy of that book in Buffalo, New York, my hometown. And once I got it, I read it from cover to cover, and it felt like William James. William James was the American inventor of psychology. Psychology was actually invented by Herbert Spencer in England, but James put it on the map in the United States. And William James, it felt as if he had written The Varieties of the Religious Experience in order to point to a bunch of extraordinarily unusual experiences, like St. Teresa every night in her tiny little stone cell in Spain, feeling Christ come through the walls, through the stone walls, and feeling Christ penetrate her body, and then having an orgasm-like experience of being married to Christ. It was astonishing experiences that he laid out, but he had no explanation for them, and it was as if he had had the courage to lay out a bunch of specimens on a laboratory bench and say, I don't have the tools in 1905 to understand these things, but I'm leaving them to you so that you, with the tools of your time, could explore them and come to understand them. So I've been after the religious experience from a secular or materialist point of view, for a very, very, very long time, and pursuing mystery is crucial to science and religion captures a whole bunch of mysteries. It's an excellent place to find mysteries gathered together for you, so that you can try to understand them. So I think understanding the spiritual aspect is extremely important. Now, I don't believe that anything goes on after we die except our influence, except what we leave behind in the ways of ideas and examples,
i.e. a legacy,
to our fellow human beings.
Like a legacy.
Yeah, but that's a personal belief, you know? I can't prove that one way or the other, and it certainly doesn't come from my science. It's just what I personally believe.
Well, and at the same time, don't we see the evidence of people's influence after their passing? I mean, from a political standpoint, look at all the people that are constantly quoting and talking about Ronald Reagan and all of the supposed great things that he did during his time.
Right. And it goes beyond that. Look at us talking about Aristotle.
And Aristotle.
300 years after his death, when I was 10, I had a conversion experience to science. I was sitting at home in a big empty living room.
And this was on the road to MIT, right?
So I was 10 years old, and I don't know where this book came from. And the book explained that the first law of science is the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And it gave the example of Galileo. Mm. And then it said, look at things right under your nose if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And it gave the example of Anton von Leeuwenhoek. Now, I was a very lonely child. No other children wanted to have anything to do with me. And my parents didn't have time for me. And all of a sudden, I found two companions, two playmates, who had no way of rejecting me. None. One was Galileo, and one was Anton von Leeuwenhoek. So two humans reached out over a distance of 350 years and saved my life. That's the kind of influence that we can have on others. And it transcends our lifetime, and it transcends our material being. And it's a part of something that, like the flame, that's like the flame, culture. And you and I are doing our best during our brief lifetimes to add to that cumulative thing called culture. And if you look at culture in the context of the cosmos, culture does what galaxies did when they assembled. And in their assembly, they brought together all the parts necessary for stars. And then the first stars caught fire. Culture is that sort of galaxy-like thing that comes from the participation of gazillions of parts. And you and I are among the parts that are creating the galaxies of intellect and emotion that are culture.
I wish that I had the perspective, and because of our individual size as human beings, we don't. But I wish that it was possible to have the perspective to be able to watch the galaxies spinning. I mean, we take a look at the Milky Way galaxy and it has these spirals. So obviously it's in a spin, but we don't see it spin.
Well, it's we've calculated it being one turn of the galaxy every 235 million years. And it has, and those spiral arms, by the way, are illustrations of something we were talking about before. When things get together, they structure their sociality. And certainly a galaxy is highly structured. All galaxies are sort of the same. I mean, they're all big potato-shaped things, and some are just lumpy, and some have these spiral arms, but one way or the other, they maintain a coherence, like the coherence of a Richard Dugan or the coherence of a Howard Bloom. They have their own personality, and they compete. Mm-hmm. Richard, competition started in this cosmos. We think that competition is a result of capitalist society and patriarchal society and post-agricultural society and post-industrial society. That's nonsense. When those atoms at 350,000 years after the Big Bang began to feel that subtle whispering of gravity that started to pull them together, they started competing with each other. Gravity balls competed with each other. The bigger always, when two went up against each other in a showdown, the big one swallowed the small one. And this swallowing process of the big swallowing the small, this bullying process, this competitive process, competition to the death, went on for billions of years and resulted in the formation of galaxies and eventually the formation of stars. Structure started in the very beginning. We think that hierarchy, you know, a boss and an employee, is again something we invented because of the post-industrial era and capitalism and patriarchy and all of that stuff. No, I'm sorry. 350,000 years into the universe's existence, when those first protons and electrons got together, there was already a dominance hierarchy. The proton was huge. It was 1,800 times the size of the electron, and the proton was the boss. Now, how can you tell when something's the boss? the electrons went wherever the proton went. The proton determined the motion because it had the mass of the atom. So we've had these structures, these social structures that have been emerging for a long, long time. The new stuff is we have imagination. No previous life form, no previous form of anything that the cosmos has ever put together has had the ability to imagine things that never were. You know, there's the George Bernard Shaw expression that Bobby Kennedy used to use. Some people look at things that are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not. Well, that capacity to dream of things that never were is unique to humans, but it's a manifestation of something the cosmos has had all along, this incredible itch to constantly jump up a staircase, an invisible staircase of form.
But don't you have to preface that by saying, as far as we know?
Absolutely. Everything is as far as we know, yeah. And one thing that we know by looking at our past or intellectual history is we know almost nothing compared to what we know 100 years from now or 200 years from now. We will look at our math 200 years from now as incredibly primitive. We will look at our science as incredibly primitive. And I would love to be around and see how we'll regard things in 200, 300, or 400 years.
One of the things that
How did you make this? You made this very interesting observation that atheists tend to be very spiritual. How have you? Because that's an amazing insight. How did you come up with that?
Well, the conversations that I've had, and I've only spoken with a few people who have expressed the fact that they were atheists, was that we would never talk about God or a universal power or a divine intelligence or what have you, but that their personal experiences and their, for lack of a better word, their moral compass. Even atheists have a still small voice. I don't know what you perceive that to be connected to, if anything, or if it's just that's just part of you. That's just who you are, and you listen to that intuition or that gut feeling or what have you. And even the individual that I spoke with a few years back made that comment that I may not believe in God, but I am a spiritual person.
And I feel that way, too. I mean, when I was hitchhiking and riding the rails, the story of which is told in How I Accidentally Started in the 60s, which unfortunately will not be out until the spring of 2017, but I was hitchhiking and riding the rails, and I rode, hitchhiked with a friend from Berkeley down to San Diego, and we went to visit his parents, who were from the Ozarks, and were very, very God-fearing people, and they were so God-fearing that when their daughter would drop a cup while she was doing the dishes, they thought that this would offend God. In fact, that it would make him furious, and they would take her and tie her wrists and her ankles to the bedpost, and they would beat the Jesus out of her. And my friend and I were extremely disturbed about this. And since his parents were Mormons, how a family from the Ozarks gets to be Mormons is beyond me, but still, since they were Mormons, we went to the Mormon Bishop of San Diego, and the Mormon Bishop of San Diego said, well, I specialize in handwriting. Would you both please write your names down on a piece of paper for me? And now, at the time, Richard, I had been barefoot for 6 months. I'd gotten to the point where I could walk over gravel and not feel it at all. My hair, no one had seen hair. It was the days of the crew cuts. It was the early 1960s, And men's hair was not allowed to get more than about a half an inch in length. But I had let my hair grow for a year, and no one had ever seen long hair on a male before, especially not curly hair. So the bishop looked at my handwriting, and he said, you are the most spiritual person that I've ever met. To me, that was me, an atheist, a scientistic person. That was the biggest compliment he could possibly deliver.
Well, you know, I don't understand it all, in spite of the fact that I've been on what I like to call my search since I was 17. And as of the date of the airing of this program, I am 40 years down. Well, I'm 56. On this date. And so I've been searching, and I remember when I was working for a Christian radio station, and I worked there for 15 years, greatest education I was ever paid for. You know, I remember sharing that with one of the ministers or pastors or one of the laity, whatever it was, whoever was there doing one of the programs with them. And they said, oh, well, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And I knew right then and there, and I said this to them, no, actually, that's not true. Once I find Jesus, my search has just begun.
Yes,
and
exactly.
I went through very pro and pro-Catholic and pro-Protestant phases. I struggled with a lot of the very fear-based theology and doctrine and dogma. Worked my way through that, and finally was able to put aside the old phrase. Well, yeah, but what if they are right? And I realized that it didn't make logical sense. Not for them to be right, but the theories that they kept coming up with to make that statement didn't make any sense. I can pursue whatever educational things that I want. I can go to any school. I can eat any foods. I can drink any beverages. I can think any thoughts. I can go any place I want. I can be with any people I want. But there's only one way to God? That doesn't make sense to me.
It's a wonderful statement. That's a wonderful statement. Because, look, let's look at it from the atheist point of view. Or let's look at it from the spiritual point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a God, then God is in every atom, every cell of our body, every thought that we have. And if we are out to gain as much knowledge as we possibly can and to push the limits of human knowledge so that each generation has more and more insight than the generation before, are we not doing God's work?
Mm-hmm.
Even if there is no God, are we not doing God's work? Isn't this a universe that is using us to try to understand herself and to understand herself in new ways and to understand herself in ways that allow her to constantly build the next step up so that we can stand on it and from it reach to the next step up, and the next step up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the cosmos does. That's what God would be doing if there were a God.
Yeah.
So even people like me who are atheists are godly to the nth degree.
And I have to say that I remember how they tried to instill some kind of fear of atheists and atheism in me. And back when I was working for this station, Madeline Murray O'Hare was still alive. And she just appeared to me, religion or non-religion aside, she just appeared to me to be a very angry person just in general. And I thought, I don't know if I ever want to interview her. But I thought, this is crazy. Why are you trying to make me afraid of all of these people? I thought that we were supposed to, this is what I thought as far as education was concerned, that as you pursued your education, it was to broaden your horizons. So one of the reasons why you went to college was to broaden your horizons. Go to the library and read the books to broaden your horizons. But now you're telling me to stay away from certain things? And every time they did that, every time they said stay away from this movie, that television program, more people went to see the movie or watch the television program, and that drove more money to the companies that they hated. And I thought, there's something wrong here. And that's when I got to the theory regarding evil. Where the biblical passage about resist not evil. And I came up with the theory or the metaphor of a brick wall. The brick wall is evil. If I go up and I try to push it down, then I'm expending my own personal energy against something. My best action is turn my back and walk away and do with the energies that I have in my body those things, those desires, those hopes and aspirations that I have, and let evil be evil, you know? Because I can't, if there is a literal devil, I can't stop him. And then, of course, if there is a literal God, God set this all in motion. It's all on him. This is not, I'm not responsible. He is, or she is, or it is, or they are.
Well, I operate on almost the opposite principle, and that is if I see a mugging taking place in the street, I try to stop it. If I see a beating taking place in the street, I try to stop it. I'm a little man. I'm 5'7.5". I don't know how to fight, and yet I have stopped. I stopped one beating, one mugging, one purse snatching, one car break-in, and terrified. I was out with the president of Sire Records, the guy who signed Madonna, when I saw somebody breaking into a car, and I took off after him, and the president of the record company was terrified. He said, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Well, I operate on the theory that if I want to live in a just universe, and I do,
mm-hmm.
then it's my job to do my part on behalf of justice wherever I can, and I don't care if the person I'm going up against has a knife or a gun. Because if I walk past, I'm contributing to a violent universe. I'm contributing to an unjust universe. So I try to stop evil wherever I possibly can.
Well, and
many times I've succeeded, and sometimes I've failed.
Right, and I might be more specific in that respect, that I would agree with you. I have done the same kinds of things. However, I don't perceive it as resisting evil in that context as much as it is promoting, if we're going to do evil and good, promoting goodness, promoting humanitarian action toward our fellow man and woman and animals and so forth. So I couldn't agree with you on that any more than you've already expressed it, I think. And I applaud you for your efforts. Succeed or fail, that's part of, if you will, the legacy that you leave that says, hey, you know, atheists are humanitarians too. They care about the species as well, and they don't want to see anybody hurt. I don't either. But I think that one of the fascinating things about this whole spiritual quest that both myself and you and others have been on, and I've been on since I was 17, specifically, and I just remember that because of the events of that time. Are that I find that we, and you've sort of elucidated this throughout the program, that we are all connected, that our actions don't just affect us as individuals, but they do even as we live, not just after we've passed on, but as we live, we affect one another.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And science bears that out, doesn't it?
Yes, because there's a new group forming. I'm one of its charter members, and it's the Evolution of Culture group. And the other day we got a mailing saying, why are so few people aware of the evolution of culture? Cultural evolution is all about how individual pinpricks manage to create a tapestry, how individuals, like the individual stars of a galaxy, make a bigger shape, a bigger whole with spiral arms and all the rest. So what we do in our lifetime is very important. It's extremely important.
I have to say the work that you are doing is right up there, and I support you in what your efforts are, and I'm very intrigued by a lot of the things that we've talked about, and I hope that maybe one day, if you find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to do continue this conversation face to face. I found, you know, talk about spirituality and energy and affecting one another. I find that if I can have a guest in studio, there's that totally different
extra
dynamic.
Energy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right.
That's just astounding. And so yeah, if you do find yourself out here, we'd love to if you can, you know, pull yourself away from New York City. And I know people who, I have a friend of mine who now actually lives, I don't know how he wound up in Missouri, but through Utah. He's a New Yorker through and through. And when I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, where the baseball team, the Diamondbacks, are from, and in 2001,
right.
When the Yankees and the Diamondbacks went up against each other and the D-backs won, he kept saying it was a fluke. And I said, no, wait a minute. I don't think you're giving the Yankees enough credit, because they fought just like any other team would. So I bet it's always been fun. Before we let you go, what website would you recommend people go to not only follow through on maybe getting a copy of The God Problem or any of your other works, or looking at articles? I mean, I've been to Wikipedia, but I don't want to send people there. I want to send people to a place that I think would give them firsthand information in regards to what you're doing.
Well, it's called howardbloom.net.
.net,
Bloom,
okay.
Bloom is with two O's.
All right.
Like the flowers that bloom in the spring.
Okay.
Or you can just go to Amazon and type in Howard Bloom.
Yeah. And you'll get all the books and all of the information. And I think that howardbloom.net would be a good website to go to. We will be linked to that website here at richarddugan.com, both the schedules page while it is posted, and then the archives or radio shows page as well, with the interview that we are fast approaching the end of. But before we go, I have three final questions for you as we wrap up this program. First of all, who is Howard Bloom?
Well, Howard Bloom is just an ordinary person like you, who comes from Buffalo, New York, and got hooked on science at a very early age, 10 years old, and has been in it ever since. And because at the age of 13 I got involved, I really became curious about the gods inside of us. I became curious about mass human behavior and the forces of history. So I did 20 years of field work in popular culture and founded the biggest PR firm in the music industry, working with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, etc., Billy Joel, a whole lot of people like that, and then went back to my science. So I try to bring as many adventures as I've been able to pack into a lifetime and all of the insights that come from them to you when I'm doing my science, and apparently it works. The Office of the Secretary of Defense, through a forum based on one of my books, and brought in people from the State Department, the Energy Department, DARPA, IBM, and MIT. So the books and the sheik who runs Dubai, now remember, I'm a Zionist atheist Jew, the sheik who runs Dubai and made it what it is today and is the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates, named a racehorse after one of my books, and the 11th President of India called my work a visionary creation, and he's a Muslim. And here I am writing The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Qaeda. So I try to pull elements from as many facets of life as possible and fashion them into new perceptual lenses to allow you to see everything inside of you and everything around you in ways you've never seen before.
And that's what we need. We try to promote the concept of observing from different points on the circle the events that are taking place within the circle. And the more points on the circle that you are able to occupy for a period of time and observe, the broader your perspective is going to be. And I applaud you for that. Second question is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, remember, when I was 10 years old and nobody wanted me, two guys reached out over 350 years and saved me. They were Galileo and Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the guy who invented the microscope. And my task is to reach out over the next 350 years and save some poor kid who's as confused as I was back then. But in the meantime, I just want to give you insight that takes your breath away.
And final question, what is your life's purpose?
It's exactly what I just told you. Okay. My life's purpose is to generate as much insight as I possibly can to open the way, to open your eyes, to open your ears, to allow you to go, oh, wow, and aha. Wow and aha experiences.
I can utter those wow and aha profusely here at the end of this program. I'm grateful for the time that you've taken to share with us from your perspective and your ideas. And I'm hoping that our listeners will take some of those ideas and incorporate them into their lives. If it resonates with you, take it and run with it. We put out a smorgasbord, and we don't force you to even come to the table. But we hope that you will and consider at least trying some of the dishes that are on the table and see what you think. And Howard Bloom, I thank you so much. HowardBloom.net's the website, and The God Problem is the book we've primarily been focusing on today, but a wide variety of subjects. And Howard, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Richard, it's been a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.